Been a day. It's been a day. It's only 10:16 in the morning, Los Angeles time. It has been a day. Hey, everybody. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Molly Wood's on the other end of this phone. Welcome back to Make Me Smart. Tuesday is where we are. Our deep dive into a single topic today. Today, the topic being what needs to happen in this pandemic to help keep women in the workforce as the burden falls unduly on them, right?
Yes. I am not saying I have a personal invested interest in this question, but I do. Those careful watchers of my Twitter feed will know that several weeks ago I predicted that as the kind of wave of school openings, the back to school days, first days, rolled across this country, people were going to realize how much of this does not work. In Oakland, we start in August. I have been realizing this for nigh on one good month. And economists warned us that prolonged school and daycare closures could lead to women dropping out of the labor force. We're starting to see companies say, great, we're opening our offices. I guess if you have childcare needs, you don't have to come in. I think JP Morgan made an announcement along those lines, which you can imagine is going to make women feel probably unduly pressured, potentially discriminated against if they are the ones who can't come in. And yes, we acknowledge that there are some men doing this work, but like not as many as I would have thought, frankly. So we thought today was the day to look at what this all means for the labor force as a whole and what we might be able to do about it.
Yep. So here's what we are going to do. We're going to talk to a woman, actually, who's she doesn't know this yet. She's going to answer all of our questions and make us all incredibly smart. Caitlin Collins is a professor of sociology at Washington University in St. Louis. Professor Collins, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Thanks for having me today.
Do us a favor, would you, and give us the lay of the land. It's been 6 months. How has this pandemic changed life for women, working women in this economy?
Well, it's upended daily life for everyone. But as both of you have mentioned already, I think it's upended daily life for women and for working mothers in particular, especially. As daycares and schools across the country have closed, the added responsibilities of trying to educate your kids, of caring for them around the clock, on top of trying to maintain your paid work, especially for those who continue to be employed and have the ability to work from home, this means that folks' homes are now, you know, an office, a school, and also a daycare facility. And so this is an untenable situation that families are somehow managing to make work. And when I say families, what I really mean is mothers. The primary responsibility for the domestic sphere in the U.S. has always fallen on mothers' shoulders. And unfortunately, in pandemic times, that disparity is, in my mind, increasing. That's what the data tend to show today. During the few first months of the pandemic, women are bearing the brunt of the disproportionate responsibility for managing these extra commitments with daycare and with school on top of their employment. They're doing more work than men are doing, and it's having a negative impact on them, of course, individually as people, but also on their ability to engage in paid work as well.
Right. And so tell us about the data part of this. The economists certainly warned us that women would end up reducing their working hours, leaving the workforce at higher rates than men. Do we have that data yet? Are we seeing that start to happen?
We do have that data. So it is women and not men who seem to be reducing their working hours. A study that I published earlier this summer with a few colleagues looked at dual earner heterosexual married couples that had children at home. And we saw a reduction in women's work hours on the order of roughly 2 hours a week in those families, with no statistically significant change in fathers' working hours. And you know, this doesn't bode well for moms in the coming weeks and months and years. And unfortunately, it confirms the pre-existing evidence that I mentioned before, which is that women are probably bearing disproportionate responsibility for this extra domestic work. And that has really negative economic consequences for them that will unfold in the coming months and years in ways that I fear are disastrous for a generation of women and of working mothers in particular.
Well, wait, don't stop there. This pandemic's eventually going to be over. So in 5 years, as we look back, what has happened?
Right.
Well, the difficulty in our labor force today is that if you step out, it is very difficult to step back in on par with where you were before. Yeah. Reducing your work hours is also very hard to make up. So put yourself in the shoes of a woman right now who is making these very, very difficult decisions. And when I say making these decisions, in my mind, these are really forced choices, right? The lack of social policies and often employer policies that are available to help women reconcile their work and family life means that the choices they face are quite constrained, right? As schools and daycares have closed, someone has to care for those kids at home, right? And very often that work falls to women. This is how we see a very real consequence of the gender wage gap playing out. I can't tell you how many families I've talked to who have said, well, I make less than my husband does, you know? So if we're going to make a decision about who's going to step out of work or reduce their hours, it's going to be me as a woman. And again, that's going to play out in ways that disproportionately negatively impact women. When we think about employers offering promotions and raises, or thinking about a new wave of layoffs. These beliefs about who we think is capable and committed on the job are very gendered in the U.S., and it tends to advantage men and disadvantage women.
I really thought this is sort of a philosophical question, but I actually really was somewhat hopeful at the beginning of the pandemic that we might start to see some empathy arise from a whole bunch of men suddenly being at home with their children, starting to see how hard this really is. I seem to have been wrong yet again. I seem to have underestimated the empathy gap in this country yet again. But really, like, I'm surprised that we're not at a point where policymakers or school principals who are men, or, you know, male executives are not saying, like, huh, turns out this is way harder than I thought it was. Maybe we should bring these learnings to work.
Molly, I think you're not alone in that optimistic outlook at the beginning of the pandemic. I think a lot of folks were saying maybe there's a small silver lining amidst the mayhem and all the awfulness right now. Maybe one small advantage of this very difficult time is that if both men and women are back at home, caring for kids around the clock, trying to navigate paid work and caregiving simultaneously, this, what has often been very invisible labor, the very boring, mundane, everyday tasks of cooking and cleaning, chores, laundry, and of course, all the work of directly caring for kids is going to be more visible to men, in addition, of course, to women having done this for a long time. And so what we hoped in before conducting that study was that we would see a concurrent drop in men's working hours who are in, again, dual earner, heterosexual married couples, where both remained employed at the beginning of the pandemic. We thought that if that silver lining played out like we'd hoped, we'd see men's a reduction in men's working hours just like women. And unfortunately, that's not what we've seen. And I don't think it's because men have somehow maliciously decided they're going to throw up their hands and not contribute at home. I think, unfortunately, it's sort of a death by a thousand cuts scenario where in everyday minute ways, this work is falling more on women than on men. And I think that you're right, that I think employers and of course the federal government can play a role in implementing policies that help reduce the work that's solely or mostly falling on women's shoulders, to divide it up a bit better between men and women, but also to give them a bit of a break and more time, job security to navigate what we know is really an impossible situation today.
So what do you make of it when companies, as Molly said, like J.P. Morgan, right, the biggest bank in the United States, is telling people, yeah, you know what, love you, it's time to go back to the office, or other companies like American Public Media have not actually put out gender-friendly policies, last I checked, and I'm going to get a call from HR and they're going to yell at me, but you know what I mean?
They should call me, too.
I will
too,
back
because...
you up.
Uh-huh.
That's right. Molly will back me up. But what are we supposed to do with that when companies just aren't having a clue.
Acknowledging.
Yes.
Just are not acknowledging the reality. Yes.
So I hear you, and I want to contextualize the comments that I hear from you. The
very
real frustration in your voice.
Yeah.
Yes, I like your anger, and I want to talk about anger because I think you are right to feel angry and frustrated. And I think that that's how change is going to happen, if I'm being honest with you. So if we zoom out a bit from individual employers just for a moment to look at the broader landscape here in the U.S. of our labor force, and the way that the federal government plays a role in helping parents navigate work and family, the United States, generally speaking, thinks of families as a very private and personal responsibility. We think parents should take care of their kids on their own, right? Which means that women should primarily take care of their children in the home, and that they shouldn't need external help for that. We talk about kids in the U.S. like pets, right? Don't have a pet if you can't take care of it all by yourself, right? Don't have a kid if you can't provide all on your own for them. The problem, of course, is that kids are not pets. Pets don't become our future teachers and nurses and garbage collectors and doctors, right? They are not our future citizens and taxpayers and voters, right? And caring for kids well is in the best interests of all of us. Thinking of kids as a public good, as an entity that benefits everyone when they are raised well, is not how we think about kids and families in the United States. I will say that outside the U.S., every other wealthy Western country has already come on board with this idea and implemented a variety of work-family policies to help parents reconcile work and family and care for kids well. So when I hear folks like yourself telling me that employers aren't supporting them in this very difficult time, I'm not that surprised, because there's no government mandate that employers do so. The employers that do offer these policies tend to be professional workplaces, white-collar workplaces that employ highly educated workers. And work-family policies in the U.S. are often implemented as recruitment and retention tactics, trying to give folks a reason to stay with them rather than move to a different work environment. But again, there's no federal mandate, for example, in the U.S. that companies offer any paid parental leave. There's no federal minimum standard for vacation or sick days whatsoever. Your employer has no obligation to give you one paid day of work off a year. And of course, we lack things like a universal childcare system and a healthcare system that would support families. So again, I'm not surprised when I hear employers not offering these policies, but of course, they're in the best interest of their workers. It's in the best interest of an employer to offer policies to help support work-family reconciliation. It's good for the bottom line for employers to keep their employees on the job, to terminate someone and then to rehire, right? The process of looking for new employees, hiring them and retraining them is much more costly to an employer than keeping on workers they already have and accommodating them, right? Study after study after study shows that these policies are good for business. And so I'm happy to have a conversation about the sorts of policies employers could implement, not only in pandemic times, but in everyday times too. Again, these are on order, you know, and very commonplace in other countries around the world. And I think it's high time the United States sort of catch up to the rest of the Western industrialized world.
Right. I mean, just and to put a fine point on it, it is, as with so many things I think we're seeing, it is all of the existing layers exacerbated exponentially by the existence of this pandemic.
Exactly. The difficulties that working parents faced, and especially working moms, these difficulties were already impossible to navigate before the pandemic. And somehow parents are making it work in even more impossible times. And I wish I could tell you that I think this is just going to change on its own, but I think it's going to involve and require some mobilization on the part of employees, right? The fact that we have very low rates of unionization in the U.S., that, again, we think of families as a private responsibility, means that in the past we haven't voted in policymakers who are prioritizing these policies. And in workplaces that have implemented them, we see either a neutral or a positive effect on things like worker productivity, profitability, and also on turnover and morale. Yeah, parental leave, flexibility on the job are absolutely important for folks like you and everyone else at your workplace to navigate this impossible time and also in the months following the recession and pandemic as well.
Caitlin Collins is a sociology professor at Washington University in St. Louis. Thank you. I feel both validated and informed.
Thanks for your time.
Take good care.
I mean, you do have to wonder what it's going to take for these freaking companies to clue in, right? I mean, the data is there. It's more profitable. Business is better. You serve more people. All of this stuff by having women who are on your board, our chief executives who are happy in their work and who are not doing everything at home by themselves. Yeah, it's bananas. Yep. Anyway.
But then something would have to change, Kai, and this is the way we've always done it.
Yeah. took me a minute. I was like, Molly, what?
He's like, who are you? Yeah. I mean, honestly, like maybe it'll take the business argument. You know my thinking on this, which is that this whole house of cards is only standing because we dum-dums keep showing up. Like general strike, America.
Yeah.
Anyway. All right. We're headed to a break. We would love to hear what you think about all of that. When we come back, actually, we are going to hear from what some of your employers are doing or not doing to help you juggle work and childcare. I cannot wait to hear, hopefully, some good examples.
If you've got thoughts about our chat with Professor Collins or any of this, anything actually you hear on the pod at all, email or voice memo, makemesmartatmarketplace.org. We are coming right back.
And we're back. We promised. Don't worry. Some things never let you down.
Oh, my goodness.
The music plays and we talk. All right. We are, before, it's just a bit of a Pavlov situation right now. Before we get to actually a bunch of your mailbox, we are going to sneak in a little news fix.
Yeah.
A little news fix.
Yeah. You want to go first? Go ahead. All right. I'll go first. So I have been, I need to do this story on Marketplace, but, barring that, we're going to do it here. There's this new thing on Wall Street, that's becoming super popular. And I just think it's really interesting from the, oh my goodness, what could possibly go wrong, category. It's this thing called a SPAC, Special Purpose Acquisition Company. They're called sometimes blank check companies. Basically, they don't do anything. They're formed, they have no operations, they have no product, they have no nothing. But they go public on the public exchanges, and then once they're public, they merge with or buy out an existing company, and in that way, take that company public. I just think it's so bleeping interesting and potentially such a train wreck in ways that, honestly, I don't think anybody can foresee. And the reason I'm bringing it up is that today we learned that Open Door, which is one of the first sort of online real estate, you don't have to go see a house, you don't have to do anything, you can just click and buy a house or sell a house things, that's being taken public by a SPAC. And it's like a $4.8 billion deal, and it's kind of magic. We're going to go public. We got nothing. Now we're going to buy this thing, and it's going to be a $5 billion company. Okay, fine. Fine. I'm good with that. And it's just, look, I don't want to be a, there's monsters under the bed, but as we saw 10 or 12 years ago, when you're not paying attention to what's going on Wall Street, it can bite you in the tuchus. And I'm just saying, that's it. Just, you know, read up on SPACs, pay attention because they're happening and big deals are being done in their name and by them. That's what I
Yeah. This is, it's so fascinating. That was such a good breakdown for it. We actually interviewed this one. We interviewed Chamath Palihapitiya, who is the CEO of this social capital venture capital fund. And he created
super influential guy, we should say, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And very radical. And he basically, like a lot of Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, feel that the process of going public is unnecessarily onerous. Sometimes that's because they don't make any money or they're WeWork and they have absolutely banana pants financial setups. So, you know, the counter argument to what they're saying is like, actually, the scrutiny that comes with filing to be a public company and therefore be public can be a good thing.
Yeah.
But anyway, he created this shell company that in this case is taking Open Door public through this kind of like backdoor. It's really interesting. We did a really long interview with him and posted the whole thing and you can hear it. I mean, you know, he maintains that the sort of the same vetting happens, but it seems like it's a little less.
Come on.
Yeah.
Man.
I mean, it's way less public.
Come
it's
on.
Way less, but it's like, it's nice.
Right.
He's like, yeah, no, we vetted him. Trust us. It's very
interesting. That ain't what's happening.
Yeah. I'm just saying, let WeWork be your guide and ask yourself how much you really want to find out about companies.
That's a good life rule right there. Let WeWork
Isn't
be
it?
Your guide. Yeah.
Don't be WeWork.
Yep.
I literally can't believe that I'm picking this story because I feel like such a downer sometimes.
That's okay. Sometimes it's me, sometimes it's you.
But you guys, the two ice shelves that prop up like Antarctic glaciers are breaking up.
Yeah.
And if these ice shelves collapse and the glaciers collapse, we are talking about sea level rise of up to 25 inches, which like doesn't sound like that much if you're talking about the height of your chair and you're a really tall person,
right?
But because it's not like a bathtub, it's not like it'll go up 25 inches, all evenly distributed. It'll be more like Bangladesh disappears.
Yep.
And then San Francisco has another drought, right? But right.
Right.
It is incredibly consequential that this is happening. Like, incredibly consequential that this is happening. And I bring it up primarily because we are in a week again where we appear to be having a debate about climate change. And that is like the greatest trick the devil ever pulled is to convince you that it is a debate or a side to choose in politics. Yeah. Because it is settled science. We're living it every day. And if you think that immigration is an issue now, wait until millions of people all over the world are having to migrate because their country disappeared.
Yeah.
Or maybe San Francisco's airport disappears and Bangladesh is suddenly fine. I don't know. But like, sea level rise at that level is a game changer.
On a day after the president of the United States, of course, said publicly, yeah, I don't think science knows what it's talking about. So there's that. But also, from my riff yesterday on the smoke from here getting over to the East Coast, I was gratified in a horrible train wreck kind of way to see a lot of people in my Twitter feed in like Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. and the middle of the country mm-hmm. saying, yeah, it was all hazy and smoky here yesterday. What's going on? And I'm like, ta-da!
You're like, yeah, sorry.
Yeah.
That was us.
That was us. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Guys, climate change, duh. Okay?
Change, duh.
It's already changed.
Right. Done deal. Yeah. Done deal. Okay.
All right.
Enough of us.
Let's let the people talk.
Now to you.
Hello, Molly and Kai.
It's Brianna from Phoenix.
Ivan from Brooklyn, New York.
Longtime listener, first time voicemailer.
I want to discuss a slightly different, but maybe related thing.
That was a new mailbag sting. I like it's that.
New.
Well done. But you know what's great about it? Is you could tell where its roots were.
Yep.
You could tell where its roots were. That was nicely done. Nicely done.
I love it. And shout out to Marketplace's intrepid engineers for finding the like snaps to Drew for finding the original audio of our slightly different but maybe related guy who will never now, thank God, never leave us. Thanks, Drew. All right. Let's get to the actual
He's sitting there
voice
in the studio
memos.
Shaking his head going, what?
Is he just looking so uncomfortable right now? He hates that when we do that.
Yeah.
He hates it. Drew, silent but deadly. All right. First up, we have a voice. First up,
sorry.
We have a voice memo.
Hi, Kai and Molly. My name is Megan Took, and I'm a full-time teacher in Clarksdale, Mississippi. And my school has made it possible for me to continue to do that and be a mom because they are providing childcare.
Oh, that's cool.
My principal has set it up so that teachers can bring their students in with them. And so even though we're teaching virtually, our kids have a place to go so that we can focus on teaching and our kids can focus on learning. It's made all the difference. And I honestly don't know what choice we would have made if that weren't an option. So just a little perspective from the Mississippi Delta. Thanks for all you do.
Well, props to the Mississippi Delta, really. I mean, that's so cool that they're doing childcare, especially for these teachers who have to deal with our kids and their own kids. I think that's amazing, actually.
That's fantastic, actually. The middle school that my son was going to last year, sadly not this year, has put what I noticed that they're doing is they bumped their start time for the school day, for the remote school day, to 10:30 in the morning, which is awesome for middle schoolers. Yeah. But they wrote to every parent and said, the reason we're doing this is so that our teachers can get their kids set up and then be able to start their day, which I thought was incredibly empathetic.
All right. So next up, Juan, who's a new listener. Thank you, Juan. Awesome to have you listen to the pod. He's got three young kids at home. Here's what he says. Both of us work, and we were lucky for my wife's job to be accommodating to be able to work from home. I work designing elevator controllers and would be perfectly able to do most of my work at home. But since our company is not, quote, forward thinking, unquote, I'm required to be at work. We had made up our minds that I would be asking for leave of absence for the first semester and reevaluate afterward, but I was able to negotiate working part-time, he says. Starting next week, I'll be working 2 days a week. Although the household income will be lower, it feels like it's a necessity to do it. Otherwise, we would be shortchanging the kids more than they already are, he ends. Yeah, it's crazy that people have to take a pay cut to be able to take care of their kids. And I know that sounds naive, but holy cow.
No, seriously, that.
Yeah.
And as Professor Collins pointed out, that is a choice that families have been making for years, right? The my job pays less than childcare costs, so I'll stay at home. But I do want to point out one of the good ones, buddy. We beat up on men a little bit at the top of the show, and here's Juan the dad taking the hit. But yes, I mean, that is a tragic choice. It is absurd, and we should all be infuriated about that.
Let me just say, let me chime in. Mm-hmm. Erica Phillips on the Slack channel with 5 exclamation points to my comment about taking pay cuts and how crazy that is. Kai, that's what women have been doing. Exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point, exclamation point.
Exactly.
There you go.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. See, you're a learning machine, Kai. Why can't come on. Lastly, we have a message from Kim Mosier. She is a self-described lawyer mom in Northeastern Oregon. And she says, for years, I've been the flexible parent. Oh, to Erica's point, doing part-time non-litigation lawyer work, less lucrative work, while my engineer husband was the main earner. I went back to full-time litigation practice recently. As hard as it was to have 2 full-time jobs in the house, along with school-aged kids, once the kids were sent home, it was all too much. I left my employment.
Wow.
I'm going to tear up. I could go on and on about how my new reentry into full-time work made my pay grade lower than my husband's, and thus making it made more sense for me to leave my full-time job to school the kids. I'll leave this note here saying, please keep talking about how the pandemic is affecting women. I need to know I'm not alone. That is such bullshit.
Oh, you're going to get us the email? Come on, man.
No, I just I just
Boosh.
Mouthed it.
Boosh.
Maybe the video might have the E.
So, Kim, we're talking about it, and this is why. This is why, right? Because it's real, and it sort of seems like, not to keep dumping on J.P. Morgan, but it kind of seems like people aren't getting it, you know?
Oh, we should for sure dump on J.P. Morgan.
Dumped on.
That was literally the first thing I thought. I was like, what if I were a parent who had to stay home with my kid? Yeah. Most likely a mom. And J.P. Morgan is, and then you're not going to benefit. It's like, I don't know. It's like a men's only golf course or something. It's like, I'm sorry, you didn't benefit from being in the room or having the conversation in the hall, or like you were slightly subtly stigmatized because you had to stay at home and take care of your kids, or maybe go on maternity leave, God forbid. Like, it just, to me, that was just like an exact emblem. And because I just read Robert Reich's book where he was basically like, Jamie Dimon, don't believe the fox who says he's fixing the hen house.
Yeah.
That to me was like a perfect example of the empathy not getting through.
Okay. So,
I'm done.
It's all good. It's all good. We have come to the Make Me Smart question, which is, as hopefully everybody who listens to this podcast knows by now, what is something you thought you knew but later realized you were wrong about? Molly Wood, you're bringing it on this one today, huh?
Yes. I talked to Bill Gates on Marketplace Tech. My dad is super excited. You can listen to the full interview on the website, marketplacetech.org. So we asked him the Make Me Smart question. This is our new thing, be better about this. And here's the answer that he gave.
We were wrong about masks. We thought they weren't a huge intervention. And thank goodness some people questioned that. And now we know that actually it's quite a phenomenal intervention. And it should be kind of non-objectionable. It's certainly very low cost. But that was because we knew so much about flu and other respiratory diseases, took a few months before people caught on to that. And, now we know, and, we're promoting it every way we can.
So that was fine, right? Mm-hmm. Fine. But it's Bill Gates. We're really?
That's come on. Billy, make me smart answer.
Come on, buddy. I mean, okay, yay, go masks. But what was so interesting is that in the course of our conversation, I had asked him generally about his work with the foundation, the Gates Foundation, and how you sort of find yourself in this stair-step position of doing the work of governments. And his answer about that was almost exactly the kind of answer was almost exactly the answer to what is something you thought you knew and you later found out you were wrong about. So we wanted to play that also. This is about malaria.
At first, I thought our role would just be to create the drugs and the nets and that we wouldn't need to fund the actual delivery side, because once we had the tools, the uptake would be there. But the delivery side, I underestimated how hard it was to figure out what kind of vaccine would be acceptable, what kind of medical intervention. You know, even how do you tell people that they really need to sleep under that bed net? And that feeds back to the design of the product because you're a partner in the delivery and you see what's not working. You know, you're driven by the limitations of uptake. And so that's why we've got to be deeply involved, not just in R&D, but also the delivery side.
Yeah, it's all about the user, right? Because the user's got to know how to use this stuff.
It's all about the user.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
And what I thought was so interesting about that is also the question that I asked him right after that is like, well, it seems like your whole career in some ways is like what happens when logic meets human behavior.
Right, 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 right. And Bill Gates, the essentially logical guy,
yep.
is like, mer? Yeah.
He's like, well, we were wrong about masks, right? That guy is like, oh, turns out.
Right.
It gets really complicated when you have to. And I just thought it was so interesting. You'll hear more like Thursday's episode of Marketplace Tech is kind of our pushback episode, the one where it's like, why is it your job to do this? And is this the right thinking? Is it the right thinking to basically say like, oh, well, the obvious solution to malaria is to find a drug and da-da-da-da-da. And then you run into people who are like, I'm not going to take that drug. Or I think your nets were made by the devil. Or I'm not going to wear that mask because you're turning me into a sheep, right?
Right.
And it's just a fascinating, like, look into how you think something is really obvious. And then you're like, oh, humans. So.
That's so much what's going on today, right now, in basically everything.
I'll say.
Humans.
Yeah. Logic versus humans.
Yes.
Who will win?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Yeah. That's what we got. That is what we got, actually. That's it for today's show. Don't forget that tomorrow is Wednesday, guys. We're cruising through it. We are
cruising through.
I'm hoping that this is going to be an upside down week where it was like hollowed out shell Monday.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's going to be uphill. At least for me, the sun is shining right now. The AQI is like 96.
Oh, is that right?
Orange is the new yellow.
I'm a little jealous.
I went on a strenuous walk today. I was like, oh my God.
Strenuous walk.
I'm not ready for a run. I don't want to, you know, that'll hurt. But. A strenuous walk we can do. So tomorrow's Wednesday. Send your questions for What Do You Want to Know Wednesday to makemesmart@marketplace.org. Subject line questions. We'll see you then.
Sorry, just waiting for the hook here. All right, there we go. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Rose Conlon. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. Ben Hethcote does video with the help of the hardest working intern in the business, Ethan Parrots. I wonder what Ethan actually does. I mean, we're propping him up. What is he supposed to actually do? I don't even know. Anyway,
it'd be amazing if we found out
that he doesn't do anything. He's been gone for 6 weeks and internship ended. What? Sorry. Anyway, Erica Phillips does our newsletter skills, and our smart speaker skills. Also, put the comments in our Slack channel every now and then. She does that.
Erica keeps us sane. Yes. Ethan. We just like him. He's just nice. He's just a nice man. Today's program was engineered by Drew Justed. Honestly, we don't even know that. That might not even be true.
No, it was.
And
I can see
it was mixed by John Garrett Dantown. Lang. Yeah. Oh, no, I meant Ethan might not even be nice.
We don't know.
We're assuming.
Come on, it's been 6 months
based on our limited interactions on Zoom.
If that even was Ethan Parrots to begin with, how do we know?
Right. Free Ethan Parrots. Right, anyway, Ben Holliday and Daniel Ramirez with the music, and the senior producer is Bridget Bodner, who definitely ran out of the room screaming. The executive director is on demand is Lataren Yebes, who's on the phone with HR right now so many reasons.
Oh, man. Just think, we get paid for this.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.